Hello everyone. In 2018, DRT started a new series of mini webinars called Case Studies with Dr. Kate. What that means is once a month, I will cover my favorite neurotransmitter case, and sometimes I will cover the neurotransmitter case with other test results that the patient might have to be able to understand what's going on with their clinical picture a little bit better. The purpose of this mini webinar series is to really focus on one case at a time and teach our providers how to use a neurotransmitter test. I hope you enjoy these and find them useful. So today we'll be talking about Anthony's case. He's a 10-year-old boy with ADHD. And for his results, we have neurotransmitters and diurnal stress hormones. So Anthony is 10 years old, like I said, and his main concern is ADHD. And he is presenting with other comorbidities that go with ADHD as well. So he has a lot of anxiety. He is irritable and nervous and forgetful and kind of all of those symptoms of quote unquote brain fog. He has been on Ritalin for 3 years. Ritalin is a medication that is commonly prescribed to control ADHD symptoms. It can improve memory and attention, increase alertness and sharpness, but it does have some side effects. The main ones are decreased sleep. Patients that take stimulants like Ritalin or methylphenidate tend to have a hard time going to sleep and staying asleep. And another side effect to consider is decreased appetite. So for a kiddo, that might be, well, not good because if they're particularly thin to start with, they can end up losing a lot of weight because they just don't have any appetite to really want to eat and enjoy food. He's also taking a cognitive support formula, and that is basically a formula that contains a B complex, vitamin D, selenium, alpha lipoic acid, huperzine, magnesium, and coffee bean extract. So a little bit of caffeine in there, a little bit of vitamin B and vitamin D. So sounds like a good formula. So let's take a look at Anthony's symptoms in a little bit more detail. He reports having some mild symptoms, such as nervousness and rapid heartbeat, along with stress and mania, and that mental fatigue, again, goes along with the brain fog, increased forgetfulness, and a little bit of aggression. And then the moderate symptoms, his main concern is ADHD, of course, and then anxiety and irritability. And again, that brain fog. So before we go into Anthony's results, I did want to spend a moment talking about ADHD. So it's a disorder that is very common nowadays. There are many kids diagnosed with ADHD, and the core symptoms of the disorder are inattentiveness, impulsivity, which is rapid, unplanned actions, kind of being that fidgety self, not being able to stay focused in school and do well in schoolwork, and hyperactivity. So kind of running in that heightened, almost fight or flight mode at all times. And ADHD core symptoms can also present with a number of other comorbidities that can go along with it. And the most common ones are anxiety, compulsivity, which is kind of synonymous with OCD, which is repetitive, irresistible urge to perform certain behaviors, sleep disturbances, social dysfunction, because children with ADHD seem to, because of their symptoms of anxiety and compulsivity and impulsivity, they tend to have less friends and they feel bad about it, so they tend to become a little bit more isolated. And last but not least, there are, well, I should say that ADHD pathophysiology is not clearly defined. That means that we don't really know what causes it, but there are a number of genetic and endocrine factors that can play a role in the pathology of presenting the symptoms of ADHD. And the neurotransmitter symptoms that have been explored more recently are dopamine, norepinephrine, glutamate and GABA, serotonin, and PEA. So dysregulation in those neurotransmitter systems seems to play a role in contributing to the the symptoms of ADHD. And I found a really great review that's a recent one that I include a reference right here. So if you're interested in learning more about all of the different systems that can be dysregulated and contribute to ADHD pathology, that would be a good article to read. So these are Anthony's neurotransmitter results. You can see that the neurotransmitter report is broken down into two groups, the main inhibitory neurotransmitters and the main excitatory neurotransmitters. And in contrast to adults, if you're familiar with the adult report, the children only have one range right here. So the adults have our range, which is based on 5th and 95th percentile cutoffs, and then the optimal range, which is the 20th and 80th percentile cutoffs. For kiddos, we only have one range, that is based on the 5th to 95th percentile cutoffs. So we can see straight off the bat that Anthony presents with some dysregulated neurotransmitters. And the easiest way to visualize this and be able to understand what all these results mean is to see them in graphical format. So this is where I go straight to the cascade and use it as a drawing tool to see which neurotransmitters are high and which ones are low. So I usually start with looking at serotonin 5-HIA first, but in Anthony's case, I'm going to start with catecholamines. So let's talk about his normal PEA, high dopamine metabolites, and high norepinephrine and epinephrine. So PEA, or phenethylamine, you can see up at the top, is actually a recognized biomarker in ADHD. There are a number of articles that talk about how PEA levels are low in urine in patients that have ADHD. And if they respond well to treatment with methylphenidate, their PEA levels will increase. So in Anthony's case, you can see that he has ADHD and he is on methylphenidate. However, his PEA is within range. So I typically don't cover results that are normal here unless they're relevant in relation to other neurotransmitters. But in this case, his results are just normal. And perhaps he started off with low PEA, but perhaps not. We're not going to know until we cover his results off medication. But I did want to bring this up because PEA seems to have such a big role in attention. Even patients that don't have a diagnosis of ADHD, what we see them report a lot is inattentiveness, mental fatigue, brain fog, when their PEA is low. And on the flip side, when somebody's PEA is really high, way above the range, we normally see that the common pattern that we see is the cluster of symptoms that have to do with anxiety, insomnia, and stress. And because PEA plays such a big role in ADHD, I did want to bring up a couple examples of how to address PEA levels, how to increase PEA levels without pharmacological treatment. So the biggest one is exercise. And exercise has been shown to have huge benefits for patients with ADHD, but that's one of the mechanisms of what exercise is doing. It's actually increasing PEA levels. Vitamin B6 and exercise together would be a really great routine to fall into, taking a vitamin B6 taking a vitamin B6 and going for a run, for example, would be a really good idea. But that's something that definitely has to be incorporated into the lifestyle of the patient. It's not something that you can take, you know, you pop a pill every morning and then helps you feel better. And there's nothing wrong with that if that's the way that the provider and the patient decide to go and it seems to be very helpful to the patient, then that's definitely the treatment paradigm they should stick with. However, if the treatment is not working very well and the patient and the provider are looking for non-pharmacological options or even maybe some natural supplementation options, then definitely exercise, vitamin B6 are the route to go. Also, perhaps introducing phenylalanine. So you can see that phenylalanine is the amino acid precursor to PEA, and taking it as opposed to PEA, which has a really short half-life, taking phenylalanine would technically boost PEA levels. The enzyme aromatic amino acid decarboxylase is ubiquitously expressed. So with just a little bit of B6, it should be smooth sailing to BEA. Foods that can increase BEA, that contain BEA in them, are beans and chocolate, eggs and peas. So those are just some examples. Okay, so let's look at Anthony's catecholamine results. So he reports a lot of high dopamine symptoms, such as attention difficulties, anxiety, irritability, mania. We do see mania in patients that have that high dopamine that's not balanced with an equally high serotonin, which previously in his results you saw that serotonin was within normal range. Mood swings and nervousness. So those are all consistent with his high dopamine results. And his metabolites are high as well, DOPEC and HVA, meaning that his dopamine tone is quite elevated. So in the report by Odes and colleagues, you can see that dopamine levels in ADHD patients are marginally higher than controls, and HVA norepinephrine levels are higher in ADHD patients than controls. One thing that I found when I was preparing for this case study was that there's no clear consensus whether catecholamines tend to be high in patients with ADHD or low. What the literature seems to agree on is that catecholamines are dysregulated, is that they can be either high or low. And it really depends on a lot of factors. It depends on the severity of ADHD. It depends on whether there are any other comorbidities that go along with ADHD, such as does the patient have anxiety, for example, alongside with their ADHD. So in this particular report, they talked about how dopamine, HVA, norepinephrine excretion tends to be higher in children with ADHD, and with methylphenidate, their norepinephrine and epinephrine increased even further. And you have to keep in mind that this patient that we're talking about today, Anthony, he is on methylphenidate. So all of these results is what his body is presenting with on treatment with a stimulant. So far we're consistent with published literature, so we're good. Let's look at his norepinephrine and epinephrine. So you could see from the previous slide that they were high, but the neurotransmitter sample that we look at comes from when our patients are asked to collect their neurotransmitter samples, they collect them in the morning, second morning, evening, and bedtime. They collect their urine on dried filter strips, and then in the lab we receive those four strips, and we take an average punch through each card and pull those samples together to get an average neurotransmitter result for the day. But because we have four cards, we can also break them up into four individual samples and look at distribution of norepinephrine, epinephrine, cortisol throughout the day and get an idea for their diurnal pattern. So all of these molecules, cortisol, norepinephrine, and epinephrine, have diurnal patterns. They're specific. So the levels at night are low, and then they begin to increase in the morning, and they stay elevated throughout the day, and then they fall at night. Cortisol has a slightly different diurnal shape. It spikes, it'll be highest about 2 hours after getting up, and then the levels will gradually decrease towards the end of the day. And they give you, looking at these patterns gives you a detailed representation of the stress response. So you're basically able to analyze the stress response for that given patient. So why norepinephrine and epinephrine? What do they do? Well, the release of these molecules into the bloodstream by the sympathetic nerve system, which is predominantly releasing norepinephrine, and adrenal glands, which is predominantly releasing epinephrine, is serving a purpose to increase heart rate, escalate blood pressure, increase respiration, so basically prepare the body for action, or that fight or flight response. You can see on the diagram over here that catecholamines are produced in the adrenal medulla. And then once they're released, these guys can signal for cortisol to be released. So these are the immediate stress response parameters, and then they signal to the long-term stress response parameter to be activated. right? And then cortisol is produced from the adrenal cortex, from this area right here. So, oh boy. All right, so the very first morning sample right here and here, this tells us what the body was doing overnight, because remember that all of these hormones are going to be collecting in urine throughout the night, and then the first morning void, they're going to be excreted. You can see straight off the bat that adrenaline or epinephrine is high for Anthony. So I wouldn't be surprised if his sleep is very fragmented throughout the night and he has a hard time staying asleep. And then second morning, evening, and bedtime for both norepinephrine and epinephrine are really high. And look how high they are in the evening before he's supposed to go to bed. I'm surprised he can fall asleep at all. If his body is telling him that he needs to be running away from the saber-toothed tiger, how can the child be possibly falling asleep? You can see that the long-term stressor is also high. Cortisol is way off our charts in the second morning collection, and it stays high, well, borderline high throughout the day. So all of his stress parameters are upregulated. I am not surprised this kid is suffering from tremendous anxiety. On that note, let's look at serotonin. So Anthony's serotonin is within range, but his 5-HIA is high. So that's telling you something is off kilter about his serotonin system. It could be overproduction of serotonin and kind of a speedier MAO that's shunting all of his serotonin to 5-HIA. So why the high serotonin production? Why the high serotonin tone? Well, it could be a number of things, and it certainly has been supported by literature findings that disrupted serotonin metabolism in ADHD. And it could be related to his genetics of kind of a speedy MAO variant, or it could be related to just heightened serotonin production by his gut. The majority of our body serotonin is produced in the gastrointestinal system by enterochromaffin cells that line the gut. And increased serotonin has been noted in individuals with IBS and food poisoning or food allergies. So kind of taking a look at that digestive component would probably be a good idea. And last but not least, we see that his glutamate is low normal, or it's low, and his GABA is normal. So that's what we have for his neurotransmitter results so far. Now, I want to spend a little bit of time talking about methylphenidate. So the review that I have right here is the most comprehensive review of methylphenidate studies I have ever seen, which is, it's tremendous. And basically the purpose of it was to assess beneficial and harmful effects of methylphenidate for children and adolescents with ADHD. And they concluded that generally methylphenidate does not increase the risk of serious life-threatening conditions. It's generally safe for periods up to 6 months. However, methylphenidate is associated with an increased risk of non-serious harmful effects, such as sleeping problems and decreased appetite. And yeah, seeing how high Anthony is in norepinephrine and epinephrine, I'm fairly certain that this kiddo can't sleep very well. So I wanted to address one more study before we go into his new set of results, and that is kind of trying to discern why don't all children and adolescents respond to methylphenidate the same way. So this is a study by Pliska and colleagues, and what they did is they compared two groups of kids with ADHD. So they looked at a group that had ADHD without anxiety, and then they looked at a group of children with ADHD and anxiety. And they looked at their urinary catecholamine levels compared to controls. So what they saw was that children with ADHD without anxiety had lower epinephrine than controls or than children with ADHD and anxiety. So remember how I said that catecholamine seemed to be dysregulated in ADHD. So depending on the severity of disorder, depending on the comorbidities that go along with it, we can't just group all the children into an ADHD group. We kind of have to tease them out and group them into, you know, groups that correspond to certain pathologies and comorbidity. So without anxiety, kids with ADHD have lower epinephrine values. Well, what does methylphenidate do? It's a stimulant. It increases epinephrine. So kids that start off with low epinephrine that are given methylphenidate for their ADHD, which works to increase epinephrine, they do well on methylphenidate. Their epinephrine is a little bit higher. They're getting that a little bit of a boost for fight or flight, not too extreme, but just enough to bring into the normal range compared to controls and, you know, other children. So they're the responders to methylphenidate. But children with anxiety to begin with and higher epinephrine values to begin with, once you give them methylphenidate, they might not respond well to treatment because their anxiety is so high, it's so intense that it's overriding the beneficial effects of the medication. Does that make sense? So you really have to assess how a particular patient is doing before deciding on the course of treatment. So running an epinephrine test to see where their epinephrine levels are to begin with may help you decide on the course of treatment that you'll take for this patient. If their epinephrine is low to begin with and introducing a stimulant might be a good idea, they might be one of the patients that respond well. Well, Anthony didn't seem to be responding very well. His anxiety was very intense. So his provider took him off of Ritalin. And his neurotransmitters were retested after 2 months. So let's take a look at what that looks like. So 2 months after discontinued Ritalin therapy, unfortunately, some of his symptoms got a little bit worse. His nervousness got worse, his stress levels got worse, and increased forgetfulness increased. The decreased mental sharpness aspect improved. So this is the updated list of symptoms that he reported. But you can see that alongside there's some new symptoms that popped up. The mania went away, but now he's talking about depression, sugar cravings, heart palpitations, and OCD. Remember that compulsivity aspect to ADHD, that, you know, intense desire to be doing repetitive actions? That's one of the comorbidities of ADHD that appeared now for Anthony. So keeping all of these symptoms in mind, let's see how his neurotransmitters changed. So you can easily visualize the changes by looking at a history report, and you can see that this is his first history report. His first OR history report in November 2016, and now we have a new set of results for January. Again, I like to look at these in a graphical format, so let's look at what it looks like side by side. So previously, he was our, well, almost brain on fire patient, running really, really high on all of these catecholamines. Now, his dopamine is low, and his DOPA and HPA are normal. Norepinephrine is still high. And epinephrine is within range. Well, what do our symptoms say? Well, low dopamine symptoms are attention difficulties, depression. Depression is a big one. We see a lot of depression and that kind of burnt out feeling in male patients with low dopamine. Mental fatigue and sugar craving. Dopamine is so fascinating. It has these centers in the brain that are, what are they called? Appetite centers. Basically, it tells you what you want to crave. So the big one is salt, of course, because dopamine regulates our sodium excretion. But it's also telling us how much sodium we want to be taking in and how much sugar we want to be taking in. It's kind of playing into that pleasure pathway. And then symptoms of high norepinephrine are still the same: anxiety, irritability, heart palpitations, nervousness, rapid heartbeat, decreased mental sharpness. I mean, this is a textbook case, basically, for our neurotransmitter adults and ADHD. This is kind of a very common set of symptoms and neurotransmitter patterns that we tend to see. Kind of, well, exciting for us to see that, but also disheartening to know that this patient is suffering from a lot of affliction that go along with his diagnosis of ADHD. So high norepinephrine, normal epinephrine throughout the day. Before I go into that, I did want to bring up this review. It does talk about how not only the levels can be low in catecholamines in ADHD, in the brain, the dopamine receptor density in ADHD patients is lower. So, and it can be true for norepinephrine as well. They say dopamine and or norepinephrine. And what methylphenidate does is it tends to increase dopamine and norepinephrine tone. And for patients that respond well to medication, that can be a tremendous thing. That can make them feel quite a bit better. But again, not for all, depending on many, many factors that I've discussed already. So I did want to spend a minute talking about the changes in norepinephrine and epinephrine. So his epinephrine actually looks normal now in the pooled sample. And I like to bring the analogy of, you can see that his epinephrine is still running a little bit high, although it's normalized in the evening and it's a little bit outside of range in the second morning. So when you average all these, the result is within range, but you can see that throughout the day, that's not entirely the case. There are time points where he looks normal throughout the day. However, second morning and evening, the levels of epinephrine are still running high, and norepinephrine as well. Again, consistent with him still reporting anxiety, cortisol is slightly worsened in the afternoon. It's now distinctly above range. So kind of perhaps for his treatment plan, considering something that would tone down that sympathoadrenal tone, maybe with adaptogens. We'll discuss some options later on, but that could definitely be a focus for his next treatment plan. Low serotonin, you can see that serotonin levels also changed without methylphenidate. Now his serotonin is low, 5-HIA is normal. Consistent pattern, if you notice that, serotonin is in the lower clinical range than 5-HIA, but the levels themselves are different. So again, introducing nervines perhaps to address this MAO, slowing it down a little bit. It's a lot easier to slow down MAO than to speed it up with botanical approaches, but it certainly is possible. Low serotonin symptoms are typically consistent with depression and low mood, but also with sleeping difficulties and sugar cravings. And I'm still wondering if some of his symptoms and low serotonin results could be coming from dysbiosis or some form of GI dysfunction that could be taking place. And here's one of the reasons why I think that. His histamine looked normal in the first set of neurotransmitter results, but now his histamine is elevated. We typically see high histamine in patients with depression and or food allergies or sensitivities. So the gut-brain action comes into play yet again. We know that gastrointestinal health can have a huge impact on how we feel emotionally. But in this particular subset, in this particular instance, I found an article that talks about how excretion of urinary histamine is elevated in patients with gastrointestinal food allergies. And eliminating that allergen can be very helpful to restoring their GI health. And we'll talk about diet in just a minute, but I did want to stress your attention to this high histamine result and perhaps implementing that into the treatment protocol as well. And now glutamate has been restored. Typically we see low glutamate, again, in patients with burnout, but it's great to see that his glutamate is now within range. So we're not going to spend too much time on it. And instead we're gonna go into some treatment considerations. So after having a chat with our ZRT docs, he here are some things that I came up with. Lifestyle is huge for ADHD. Diet, exercise, good sleep hygiene, and biofeedback. And before, you know, whoever's listening to this case webinar, before you know, your eyes glaze over when I say diet and exercise, because that's what everybody talks about, and we've talked about it so much that hearing diet and exercise makes people tune out. And it kind of sounds like white noise at this point, but this is so important for ADHD. And here's why. I wanted to show you some studies that specifically focused on diet approaches to ADHD. So the report on the left, they looked at sugar-sweetened beverage consumption and ADHD symptoms, and they saw that there was a dose-response relationship between sugar-sweetened beverage consumption and worsening of ADHD symptoms. So eliminating sweeteners, sugars, food dyes plays such a big role in contributing to adverse pathological symptoms of ADHD. Removing artificial food colors improves ADHD symptoms. There are so many articles out there. I had a hard time choosing which ones to show here, but those are the main ones. And my favorite one is by Nig and colleagues on restriction elimination diets in ADHD treatment. Basically, they concluded that 30 to 40% of ADHD kids can be tremendously helped with finding out the source of their food sensitivities. Eliminating it can help them feel better tremendously. And look what they concluded. Perhaps a minority of 10% of children with ADHD, response can include a full remission of symptoms equivalent to a successful medication trial. In short, the literature suggests that an elimination diet should be considered as a possible treatment for ADHD. Did you hear that? 10%. That is 1 in 10 children can receive full remission of ADHD symptoms. Just consider that. Diet is so important for controlling the symptoms of ADHD. Okay, this is an article talking about benefits of exercise for ADHD patients, and it has to be regular, has to be intense, and it shows a great deal of clinical benefits. Next one is the importance of good sleep hygiene. And, you know, this talks about be consistent, maintain a regular sleep routine, avoid naps, no electronics before bed, no video games, no TV, no caffeine after, well, kids shouldn't be on any sort of caffeine anyway. Reducing sugar, artificial sweetener consumption, everything that I talked about in the diet section, quiet, dark bedroom, and getting exercise regularly, but not right before bedtime because that can have a stimulatory effect due to that elevation of PEA. The articles here talk about how improvement in sleep quality and reduction in ADHD symptoms after implementation of the sleep hygiene routine, how important it is to maintain a good sleep hygiene for ADHD patients who tend to have fragmented, kind of poor quality sleep compared to controls. So anyway, that's that. And then the last but not least, I wanted to bring to your attention a couple of studies that looked at neurofeedback. So neurofeedback is basically, it can be an app on the phone that uses, you have to purchase an extra device. So it can be a chest strap, a wrist strap, an earpiece, basically something to take vitals over the course of the breathing exercise. So the app tells you how to breathe, and then the app also tracks how your heart rate, how your sympathetic nervous system is responding to what you're doing. So there's a number of really great neurofeedback apps. Some of them are HeartMath and EquiSync, Elite HRV. So those are just some ideas. But these studies talk about how implementing neurofeedback can be as effective as pharmacological intervention. So think about that. For children like Anthony who don't respond well to treatment, that is certainly something worth giving them a try. So on the next slide, I put together other treatment considerations that can go along with the lifestyle changes, but I think the lifestyle changes would be the biggest. Neurotransmitter support specifically for Anthony would be focusing on his dopamine and serotonin tone. So there's a couple options there. For dopamine, tyrosine, amino acid supplementation would be good, or Mucuna, which is an herbal supplement that has high levels of L-DOPA. So you're bypassing that rate-limiting step and going from tyrosine to L-DOPA. You're just giving him straight L-DOPA in Mucuna. Serotonin, 5-HTP, again, similarly to L-DOPA, 5-HTP bypasses the rate-limiting step, and it's just smooth sailing to serotonin. That's one way. It's been shown to help patients sleep better and to improve their mood. St. John's wort is another one. For PEA, vitamin B6, exercise, phenylalanine, even though his PEA did not change much with or without methylphenidate, his PEA stayed the same. Considering elevating it for him to try and see if that can improve his attention. And L-theanine. L-theanine is a really great modulator. It modulates dopamine, serotonin, glycine, GABA. It improves focus and attention. It kind of directs your brain into the alpha state, kind of that meditative, relaxed, but alert state from the task-oriented beta wave state. So L-theanine is really great. Also considering some stress system support with adaptogens or nervines and general wellness, staying with magnesium and B complex, vitamin D, inositol. It's a really great receptor modulator, and it modulates a lot of neurotransmitter receptors non-specifically. So that means it has affinity for dopamine, serotonin receptors. Introducing that might be a good idea because that one review that I showed you guys, dopamine tone is low in patients with ADHD. So introducing inositol might help augment that dopamine receptor function. Fish oil would be also great for general wellness to quell any sort of inflammatory conditions that could be going on. If you want to know more about magnesium, Dr. Greenblatt did a blog for us, and then he also, so this was for kids actually, talking about mineral imbalances in ADHD. He also did a webinar for us that was for adult ADHD. You can also check out his book, Finally Focused, where he talks about all of these different mineral approaches to ADHD. And that's it. That concludes Anthony's case. Stay tuned next month. I'll have Julia's case. She's a postmenopausal female with sleep issues, anxiety, and depression. I'll be talking about her neurotransmitters and saliva steroids. And thanks for listening.